Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Colin Mustful, your host today, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Luis Martinez Fernandez, author of the book Key to the New World, A History of Early Colonial Cuba. Dr. Martinez Fernandez, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Colin. I'm honored by this invitation.
Dr. Luis Martinez Fernandez is a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. Born in Havana, Cuba, and raised in Lima, Peru, and San Juan, Puerto Rico, he holds a BA and MA degree in history from the University of Puerto Rico and a PhD degree in history from Duke University. He is recognized as one of the most prolific and influential scholars in the field of Caribbean studies. He is the author of numerous publications, and his new book, Key to the New World, is the winner of the 2018 Florida Book Awards Bronze Medal for Nonfiction. Dr. Martinez Fernandez, before we delve into the book, I wonder if you could tell us about your background growing up in Latin America and how you became so interested in its history.
Sure. I often think that it was almost unavoidable that I'd become a historian because of my own life trajectory. I was born in Cuba in 1960, which was, of course, the second year of the Cuban Revolution, and it was to put it in the mildest terms, a very volatile situation, and my family left the island in 1962. After a brief stay in Miami, we resettled in Lima, Peru, which, of course, although it's part of Latin America, it's a very, very different country. There, I spent 8 years. As you know, those first years of life are very important in shaping your mindset and actually the future of your experiences. 1968 was a year of turbulence in Peru, a military coup d'etat. My father then decided that it was a good idea to leave Peru at the time. So by the age of 10, I had lived through a revolution, a coup d'etat, two exiles, and I think all of that sort of led me into the field of history as trying to figure out why did all this happen? And of course, Peru is a country with a very rich history, and living there and visiting various historical sites, Atahualpa's ransom room, for example, where Pizarro forced the Incas to gather a treasure. That was one of the sites that I saw early on. So I would say that, you know, all of these experiences, very historical, quote unquote, sort of pushed me in the direction of an interest in history.
Oh, yeah, wow, I can definitely understand how that might happen. So why the interest in Cuba? Have you gone back since you were born there?
Yes. Well, the interest in Cuba I was always a foreigner, whether it was in Peru or whether it was in Puerto Rico, here in the United States. So Cuba to me is it's home in a historical sense. I did research on Cuba for several years without the opportunity to visit Cuba. But then relations between Cuba and the U.S. started to open up. And in 1994, those who were born in Cuba and had U.S. passports were allowed to return. And that was my first year there, actually, to visit for research purposes and also to get to know my country, which I had not been there since 82. And since then, I visited 10 times, again, for research purposes.
Well, have you had a chance to just be a tourist and enjoy the landscape, culture?
Well, sure. The research was the main motivation, but I really wanted to know the island and have the experiences of everyday Cubans, enjoy and the diversity of the island. Of course, Havana is a fascinating city with an incredible architecture. Places towards the center of the island in Cienfuegos, for example, beautiful topography. Columbus was in awe when he saw Cuba for the first time. So there are many different regions in Cuba, and they're very diverse. Some of them are lush tropical vegetation. Others are semi-desertic. I did that and, you know, get to know the Cuban people, which was an important part of my self-discovery and which was also important for me to be able to write about Cuba and its people.
Let's talk about the book now. I think you say that it started out as a collection of essays, but it was reading the book is really hard to tell that they were separate. How did you manage to bring them all together into one collective resource?
Yeah, that's a very good question because I started out writing, and I believe the first one I wrote had to do with the Colombian encounters and 1492 and how the world, not just Cuba and the Caribbean, changed, but how the world was transformed. So that was the first one. And then I wrote another one, and it sort of became, I wrote a second one, and then I thought, gee, nobody has written a comprehensive history of colonial Cuba in, believe it or not, and it's hard for me to say it, in 100 years. And I thought, well, I'm going to write a couple more. There was one on the indigenous population. And then, as you said, it was not just a collection of essays, as you often see, which are disconnected, but I made an effort to have a common tone, a common style, to make it read as if these are actually chapters in a book rather than disjointed essays. That was not easy, I will add. It took several revisits to the manuscripts and make sure that there was a coherence to the story.
Well, you definitely accomplished it. You just mentioned your common tone and style. That was one thing I was really impressed with, the objectivity you were able to convey this history with. Even though it is such a polarizing topic nowadays in how we perceive the discovery, quote unquote, of the Americas. So talk about dealing with this history with objectivity, even though it might elicit certain emotions or preconceived biases.
Sure. Historians, the same way as journalists, there's always a degree of bias because we bring to the table ourselves, and that includes our prejudgments, preconceptions, our own experiences. So what I tell my students is that we cannot expect absolute lack of bias, but what we can always expect and actually what we should demand of authors is that they are honest and that they make an effort to deal with whatever biases may be there. My previous book was on the Cuban Revolution, and you can imagine how controversial that is. And precisely because of that, I made an effort to eliminate bias and eliminate any angle that may be unfair to the narrative. Now, going back all these centuries to early colonial Cuba, as you said, these topics can also be very volatile. The topic of Columbus, for example, we know that all throughout the Americas, statues of Columbus are coming down, defaced or vandalized. And all of that is, of course, very, very political. Now, what I tried to do was to sort of avoid any notion that this is about heroes and villains. And in that chapter in particular, I wanted to do something different. So what I attempted to do was, okay, circa 1492, a time of profound transition in Europe, a time when we have a movement away from the Middle Ages and towards the Renaissance, which brings an entirely different worldview. And what I did was used 1492 to tell the story of two individuals who represented two different worlds. Columbus, on the one hand, who was very strongly influenced by the scholasticism and the religious Catholic ideas of the times. And then on the other hand, we have Amerigo Vespucci, who was indeed a scientist and who used the inductive method. And therefore, while Columbus really struggled to find, to figure out what these territories were, and he was coming up with ideas based on the Bible, once something else happened and that thesis no longer worked, then he looked for something else, which is in high contrast with Amerigo Vespucci, who was really conducting the explorations as if he were a scientist, which he was.
You talk about Columbus, and obviously he's an important figure in this history, and it's someone we all know about. But throughout the book, you also talk about Diego Velázquez. I wonder if you could compare the two and talk about who Velázquez was and what he did as a part of Cuban history.
Yes. Columbus was a discoverer, if we may use that term. He did not engage in the actual settling of the Caribbean, although he lived for a while in the capital city, Santo Domingo, of the Dominican Republic. But on the other hand, Diego Velázquez was a conquistador. And one of the things that I try to convey in this book is that those Europeans, particularly Spaniards, who came to Cuba to conquer, they themselves were the result of medieval Spain, the Spain of the Reconquista, which means the 7th century process of reconquering Spain away from Muslim domination. That created a very militaristic society. It created a hierarchical society. It created a society in which monarchs at that time were not absolute monarchs, but rather they had to share power and wealth with the military. And it was precisely men like Diego Velázquez who arrived in Cuba and wanted to establish something that was very similar to the world of the Spanish Reconquista. Of course, there were no Muslims in Cuba and the rest of the Caribbean at the time, but what he tried to do was to use the indigenous population as serfs, and a number of institutions that were in place in Iberia were adapted to the new world. For example, the encomienda, which was a practice of not enslaving, but having the indigenous population be the vassals of the monarch. As it turned out, the encomienda became very corrupt, and the indigenous population became virtual slaves. So it's important to know men like Diego Velázquez and those who came with him, because they had a certain set of aspirations, and the aspirations were to gain prestige, power through military activities, but also there was this component of not just making money, but also of gaining social prestige through titles, through land ownership. It's very interesting how that generation of conquistadors created something from scratch, which was similar to what had transpired in Iberia.
Well, you've talked now about the religious context of Columbus, and also now the political context of Western Europe, and I'd just like to praise you for including that context, because I think it's very important to understanding history.
Well, thank you very much. I see history that way, and actually, I've always been, as a historian, sort of a rebel, and in a way, rebelling against that micro history that is so focused on a particular area and a particularly short period of time. So the way I like to see history is, you need to understand the broader Atlantic context in order to understand what's happening in the island of Cuba and the rest of the Caribbean.
Well, speaking of micro and macro history, I think that's something you talk about in your introduction. You say you separate the book into three different aspects, the micro, the macro, and then the human element. Talk about how you did that and why you did that.
Yes, I did that on purpose, and actually that also speaks to what we were talking about earlier, to have a book which is not just isolated chapters, but it flows through as a single unit. The macro history, the broader context, as we just spoke, is very important. You need to understand the trends in the Atlantic, whether they have to do with religion, whether they have to do with mercantile aspects. You need to understand that the gold and silver that flowed from the Caribbean and Mexico and elsewhere to Europe created a price inflation, and how that had reverberations in the Caribbean itself. So that's important. Now, that, to most people, myself included, is not as appealing as understanding the human element of history. So there's one strain, if you will, and that's understanding the macro. The second one is looking at the micro within Cuba. And by micro, I mean understanding that Cuba, from the very beginning of its colonial history, was also very different in different parts. We see Havana, which is a very small part of the island, but it becomes an enclave of church power, political power, military power, where the population is regulated. There's a large presence of the state. And so that's one micro area. And then we look at other particular areas, for example, the sugar plantations, which were in the outskirts of Havana. That's a different world altogether. It's more of a seigneurial type of context in which the planters play a role, not just economically, but also in terms of social prestige. And then another micro area would be the hinterland. Those places where there's a small presence of the state. Therefore, people are freer to move around. That is a context in which we find a very interesting propensity towards racial mixture. Different groups come together, surviving indigenous populations, freed slaves or slaves who fled and became Maroons, some Spaniards, and you see how these different groups come together in a more egalitarian way in the context of the frontier, whereas Havana is much more highly hierarchical, and it's not conducive to this type of egalitarian type of relationship among different groups. So that's the other level, micro. And then I'm really convinced, and that's one of the things that I've been striving to do in my writing, is that people love stories. And people love stories of individuals that they can relate to. People love stories of common people. It's not just, you know, the big names, the Columbuses or the Diego Velázquez's. No, I made an effort in every single chapter to bring out one, two, maybe three characters, not necessarily famous people, but everyday individuals who were impacted by the macro and micro level developments, but who also contributed to those, excuse me, to those developments. And that's where I really find that it's one of the strengths of the book, that the reader is being taken by the hand and shown the huge vastness of the Atlantic world and then the regions in Cuba. But then at another level, we have these real human beings who struggled in Cuba, who faced challenges, persecution, some of who were very successful at doing what they were doing. And so those are the three. And I wove those three threads throughout the book.
Well, you did an excellent job, and I definitely enjoyed some of those anecdotes. Did you have a favorite in particular?
Well, these things are so incredible. As I said, there may be one, two, at least two or three in every chapter. There's one of Paula de Aguilú, who was a woman, a black woman, who was born in Santo Domingo, moved, was sold to an owner in Puerto Rico. Then she was sold again to somebody in Cuba. At the heart of this was the jealousy of the wives of the owners. She was a very sensual and described as a very beautiful and elegant woman. So she ends up in Cuba in the eastern part of the island, and she marries one of the wealthiest men in Cuba, who was in charge of the copper mines in the area of Santiago in the eastern part of Cuba again. Now, she gets involved with witchcraft. And what's fascinating about her story is that I use her as a window onto broader historical phenomena. So it's not just her story, as interesting as it can be, but also the fact that in Cuba, she gathered ideas and practices from the indigenous religious culture, healing herbs, but she also embraces the pharmacopoeia and the religious practices of West Africans and also European witchcraft. She embraces all of that and she begins to practice witchcraft, for lack of a better term. One day, the Inquisition knocks on her door, and she's arrested and ends up in Cartagena. Now, this is a fascinating story. She was so elegant. It's a good thing that Spanish bureaucracy, in this case, the Inquisition, took such good records of what was happening. There is a list of her wardrobe because she was arrested and her belongings were confiscated. So they created a list, an inventory, I should say, of her clothing. I think that she may have had the richest and most elegant and luxurious wardrobe of anybody in Cuba, any woman in Cuba. And yet she ends up in the Inquisition. She's judged one time, and then she does it again. She goes back to the Inquisition's prison. In the end, the great irony of this woman is that she ends up wearing sackcloth, which was sort of a punishment by the Inquisition. And to see this woman who had the most luxurious wardrobe ending up in a prison in Cartagena, it's just a fascinating story. Another one of a governor in Cuba, actually not a governor, but he was in charge of the main fortress in Havana. Another set of records that captures beautiful details are the impeachment in Cuba was a practice, a Spanish colonial practice, that anytime any individual ceased in his or her official appointment, well, actually in his, there were no women in official appointments at the time, they would be judged by none other than that person's successor. And the kind of detail that we find of the usually misdeeds of those who were being judged are fascinating. In his case, he became creolized in a way, and he was criticized for degrading the position of the chief of that fort. He was accused of dressing in women's clothes in the street, accused of eating plantains that were fried in the streets, all of these things that somebody of his position should have not done. So it's wonderful to have these materials and be able to recreate their life histories, which are not just interesting, but they're also very revealing of the times and the struggles of the period.
Yeah, amazing stories. And I can only imagine what it was like for you to come across those documentation and discover those stories.
Oh, yes. That's, as a historian, that is one of the sources of greatest happiness. Sometimes you spend hours looking at documents and see, read information that is repetitive and not really interesting. But then all of a sudden, one afternoon, you open a file or a folder of documents, and there is something seemingly out of this world. That's very rewarding.
I was fascinated by some of the information you had about pre-contact. The book goes all the way back to Cuba's first settlement 6,000 or 7,000 years ago. Talk about how you did your research for that period of history, and give us a little summary of what pre-contact Cuba was like.
Sure. That was perhaps one of the hardest of the chapters to write. The reason being that when I originally wrote that chapter a few years ago, our knowledge of the pre-Columbian populations was very limited. But there have been so many important developments in technology, scientific developments, to be able to measure a number of things, such as determining the diet of the indigenous populations based on studies of the bones, etc. So much has happened in the last 15 years that it allowed me to and actually forced me to become familiar with the broad and growing literature on the indigenous populations of the Caribbean. Now, some of the things that I learned had to do with the fact that the way in which the Caribbean indigenous population has been looked at is as if this was just a snapshot of the region. And usually the way the story was told was, okay, this is 1492, the year of contact, and this is what the Caribbean was like. So in this island, in this part of the island, we find certain groups that were more advanced technologically. In that other island, the level was slightly lower as far as technology goes. But when you look at the Caribbean that way as a snapshot, it's not as rewarding as if you look at it as if you were taking a video that moved a long time, across time. For example, if we look at it that way, we see that there was incredible interaction between the islands of the Caribbean and Mexico, Florida, and South America. And we find trade, for example, items that were produced in what today is Colombia, for example, such as jewelry, certain pets that were used as a symbol of distinction were also brought from elsewhere. And then it also forces you to see the relations among the different groups in the islands in a different way. One of the things that I was able to discover was that we look at the Taínos, which were the most advanced of the groups. They were Neolithic. They had agriculture, they herded animals, they lived in villages, they were the most advanced. And then we look at the other groups that are referred to as archaic Indians, and they were old Stone Age, no agriculture, no animal herding, they were just basically hunters and gatherers. So how do we explain the fact that the Taínos were so advanced? They had such a complex society, a hierarchy, the development of the arts, and then this other group was so primitive. Well, the explanation that I was able to come up with was that we are finding that what made Taíno society so complex was that these groups of settlers were taking over the archaics, and then they turned them into the working masses, which allowed the elites to develop the arts, religion, and so on. So it's interesting to see how, in order to understand the complexity of the Taínos, who developed villages that had about 1,000 people, which was quite significant at the time, developed beautiful artifacts that were used in rituals or vases. How is that possible? So one of the possible explanations that I find is that, well, once they take over the other population of archaics and those become the working masses in agriculture, then the society becomes complex.
Well, let's move forward to the changing demographics of Cuba as indigenous populations mixed with European, mixed with African, and something you call a Cuban stew.
These are two parallel processes. On the one hand, we see a biological mixture as individuals from different racial and ethnic backgrounds come together, have children, and produce a population that is not all white or all black or all indigenous, whatever that means, but it is a population of mixed racial ancestry. So that's the biological face of this process. On the other hand, we find a process that is far more interesting, and that is culture. A famous Cuban anthropologist by the name of Fernando Ortiz came up with this metaphor of Cuban culture being a stew, which is Cuba's national dish, which is called in Spanish un ajiaco. So that stew is used by Fernando Ortiz as a metaphor for Cuban culture. So how does this work? Okay, well, you have a stew, and that stew includes items, ingredients from these three different ethnic and cultural backgrounds. So you have items such as corn and some of the, not potatoes, but tubers that were indigenous to the Caribbean. Those are in the mix. Then the Europeans come and they bring their own ingredients. Chicken, for example, was not known. Cattle was not known. So we have the beef, we have the chicken, we have the onions and the garlic, which were also imported from Europe. And then we have the African population, and their culture is strongly associated with the consumption of bananas and the consumption of yams. All of these ingredients come together in this Cuban stew. Now, as you know, in the United States, we talk about the melting pot as a metaphor for cultural development. That's not the case in Cuba because these ingredients are not melted. They don't become something uniform. What actually happens in this stew, and if you ever visit Miami, I would encourage you to have that dish, which is so delicious. What makes it so delicious and important and special is that these ingredients retain their own flavors, their own textures, their own aromas, but at the same time, they impact one another. So you have the onions, for example, impacting the yams and the corn impacting the other ingredients. And this is the metaphor for Cuban culture, which in essence means, yes, these ingredients come from different backgrounds. They're mixed together in this Cuban stew. But the important part of it is that you don't find an attempt to create something that is uniform, like the melting pot, but rather a culture in which these different ingredients retain their own flavors and at the same time create something new and very complex.
So we haven't talked much about slavery. Talk about how that contributed to Cuban history. And also, you talk a lot about the resistance of slaves. I wonder if you could mention that.
Sure. These two stories go together hand in hand. On the one hand, the master class in its attempts to enslave the natives and in that process, enslave the African imported individuals, and in the process an attempt to take their culture away from them in different ways, including religion. Now, even musical culture, because it's fascinating to see how throughout the Americas, wherever slaves lived, the master class and the authorities tried to ban musical practices such as playing drums because they were viewed as potential ways of communicating and organizing revolts. On the other hand, you have the slaves' attempts to combat that unnatural situation of being enslaved. And you see that from the very beginning, even in the slave vessels, when slaves are trying to escape slavery, no matter in what way. And one of the saddest ones, of course, was to escape slavery through suicide. So these two stories are intertwined. The master class trying to subjugate, not just physically, but culturally, the slaves, and the slaves very instinctively from the beginning trying to escape that system of oppression. Slavery was very important in Cuba from the beginning because the indigenous population was disappearing. There were two ways in which this was happening. On the one hand, by death, the diseases brought by the Spaniards, for which the indigenous population did not have any antibodies. They decimated the population. Of course, there were battles in the conquest in which thousands of indigenous people were killed. And then also the fact that many of them starved because the conquest turned upside down the ecology and the farming system of the natives. For one thing, when the Europeans came and they let loose animals such as pigs, horses, goats, cattle, that had a negative impact on the farming practices of the indigenous. And then, even more sadly, the fact that their whole world was turned upside down, the religion, so many aspects, that many of the indigenous people lost the desire to live and have children. So the records by the chroniclers show how many of them committed suicide. Abortions became very common because mothers did not want to bring children into this world that had become hellish since the arrival of the Europeans. So because the indigenous population sort of disappeared, and I want to be very careful saying sort of disappeared, because that population also mixed into other racial groups, and therefore they became Hispanicized. Now, the Europeans also believed that the natives could not sustain the harsh work that we associate with sugar production, including the harvesting of the sugar cane with machetes. And there was an emphasis on bringing African slaves who were believed to be better equipped physically to sustain that rigorous system of labor. If you look at the historiography of the Caribbean, what has been written on the history of those societies, you will find a very intimate connection between sugar and slavery. For some reason, slavery, and even to this day, sugar production requires a type of very regimented labor that is either slavery, which no longer exists, of course, in the Americas, or whether it's a coerced type of work. We don't have to go too far. Here in South Florida, sugarcane is produced, and the workers who are imported, for the most part, from Jamaica and Haiti, live under conditions that are very similar to those of slavery, unfortunately, all these centuries after the original arrival of slaves. So that's the other reason sugar and slaves went together, not just in early Cuba, but really throughout the Caribbean. That's, I think, the saddest part of the history of the region, how sugar, which was so profitable, it's important to keep in mind that during those early centuries, sugar was a luxury item, very valued in Europe, and therefore it produced enormous profits for the planters and also for the merchants involved in the trade of sugar.
Well, I think you call sugar and slavery a binomial that's the most significant transformative and enduring factor in the history of the Caribbean. So it's definitely something you cover in the book.
Yes, and enduring because even though slavery no longer exists in the Caribbean, we do see the legacies of the slave system and the legacy of the hierarchical system around slavery still today. For example, many scholars and some literary figures, Jamaica Kincaid, for example, study the current situation in islands of the Caribbean, and they find an association between the sugar plantation world and contemporary tourist industries in the region. It's, you know, the hierarchy is still there. The fact that circumstances make it very difficult for individuals to survive outside of the tourist sector, which is relatively well-paying. The fact that there's a dependency on the outside world in sugar. If you don't have consumers, if you don't have a world market, you can't go forward in the hotel industry. If you don't have a foreign population who's willing to pay for hotels and restaurants, then the tourism will not happen. It's interesting to see how after 9/11, one of the sectors that became affected throughout the Caribbean in large measure because people feared traveling was tourism. So we see that dependency. For many centuries, the dependency was on how much is the world market willing to pay for sugar. We now see a different relation between the tourist industry and the world market.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, the lasting legacy, not just of slavery and its connection to sugar production, but about how Cuba is like today and how it's been affected by this history of contact and the encomienda system and all those things you write about in the book. How has that contributed both positively and negatively to Cuba today?
Yes, that's an important question. And actually, my previous book, Revolutionary Cuba, A History, delves into that. In other words, how can we understand what has transpired in Cuba during the revolution? Where do we find the roots of that? And of course, the roots are very, very profound, going back to the 1500s. Let's start with colonialism. Cuba, of course, was a Spanish colony, and as such, endured oppression and endured exploitation. It was countries in Europe and later on the United States that provided a market for Cuba and sort of pushed Cuba into a monocrop economy, meaning that sugar was the overwhelming product. Now, that continued in Cuba actually until very recently, because even though Cuba became independent from Spain, there were certain mechanisms, tariffs, incentives, and restrictions on manufacturing, indirectly so, that explain why Cuba during the 1940s, 50s, 60s, well, actually until 1961 or so, was so dependent on the U.S. market for Cuban sugar. Now, once the United States is out of the picture as trading partner of Cuba, the Soviets and Eastern Europe and China, to some extent, become the markets for Cuban products. Again, we see how Cuba fails to industrialize to a level that would liberate the island from that dependence of sugar, how Cuba fails to diversify its agriculture, and what we see happening during the 60s, 70s, and 80s is that Cuba is still dependent on one product, sugar, from one market, basically the Soviet Union and a few socialist countries in Europe and Asia. That is what I mean by the enduring legacies. A country that by circumstances and by actions of the ruling powers was forced into depending on sugar, and how that never really changed until about 10 or 12 years ago, when sugar is really basically out of the picture in the Cuban economy. The other thing has to do with coerced labor. Now, I don't want to come across as saying that revolutionary Cuba was a slave system, because it certainly was not. I want to make that very clear. But what I want to say is that the coercion of labor, which we see happening under slavery during the 1500s and forward, and then we see intensifying in the 19th century. And then after abolition, what we find is that the master class and the elites, even though they've liberated the slaves, reluctantly so, they still continue to apply mechanisms that keep the former slaves from freedom in terms of, for example, accessing their own land and being able to become what they always wanted to be, which was peasants who were independent. And then we see when we walk into the Cuban Revolutionary era, how the regime used a variety of coercive mechanisms to have workers in sugarcane. Any worker who has an option would rather do something else than cut cane. The mechanisms in place were such as, well, if you were a prisoner, you would cut cane. In Cuba during the 1960s, there were concentration camps, believe it or not. In many instances, they included dissidents. They also included gay men. They also included religious people who were sent to these institutions. And guess what they were used for? They were used to cut cane. Also, beginning around 1963, the Cuban government used military conscripts, and they were forced to cut cane. Later on, Cubans who applied for exit visas, I know a few of them personally. Okay, you want to leave Cuba? Well, this is what you have to do. You have to cut cane for a couple of years. 1970 was the year of the heralded 10 million ton harvest, in which Castro believed that we can only get 10 million tons of sugar, we're going to get so much capital that we're going to invest in manufacturing and we will finally be free from sugar. Well, guess what? It didn't happen. It reached barely 8.5 million tons, which was not enough for those goals. So what happened in the harvest of 1970? These things that are hard to believe, and sometimes I tell my students, well, imagine the government decides that we're going to have this massive mobilization of workers. and the government decides that this university is going to be closed, and not just this one, but all universities and even high schools, and me, the professor, and my students, we're going to be working cutting cane. Professors are usually not very good at that. So that's another way in which it's so important to understand the early history of Cuba to later understand what has transpired in Cuban history over the past century. That was one of the main motivations for me to study that period.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly makes sense then that the book cover is a sketch of a sugar cane.
Yes. I like to get involved in almost every aspect of the book production, including the cover. As you know, the decision about the book cover is a marketing decision based on what they feel, the publishers feel would be attractive. They pay attention to the spine of the book. When people walk by a shelf of books in a bookstore. But I like to work with the images myself. One of the most rewarding aspects of putting this book together was a selection of the various illustrations inside the book. And I also designed the cover, which, as you said, has a couple of cane stalks. And this is a sketch actually from the 1700s that one day I came across with, and I said, gee, this would be a good symbol for the cover. But also I think it's very aesthetically pleasing. It's a minimalist cover, as you see, but it was something that I really enjoyed selecting the font, which would be relative to the 1500s, even the color of the font. It's a pleasure to be involved in the process of creating the cover as well.
Well, congratulations on a great book, from the cover to the content. I feel like we could talk about it forever. But why don't you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I always have a line of book projects, and the one that I'm currently working on is related to some of the stylistic resources that I use in Key to the New World. One of the fascinating things of being a historian, and being a historian for decades, is that you get to travel to archives, find materials that seem incredible, find characters that seem to come out of the pages of a novel by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And these were actual happenings. Over the last 15 years, I've been gathering materials, documents, information about slaves and former slaves in Cuba and the Caribbean who for some reason had an extraordinary existence. This is one of them, for example, which is a wonderful view into slavery and the beliefs of the slaves. This comes out of a engineer's diary. A man from New York who was living in Cuba in one of the plantations, and he was in charge of the machines. This was quite common, actually, to have these engineers from New England and New York working in Cuba. So he keeps a diary. And one day he observes, he's near the shore, and he observes that an African slave, probably Creole, born in Cuba, or probably African, actually, he hops onto a little rowboat, and he starts pushing the rowboat to the beach, and then he hops on it and begins to row. The engineer is baffled because, and he asks the man on the boat, "What are you doing? Where are you going?" And his response was just shocking. He said, "I am going to my homeland in Africa." This is Cuba. Of course, you can't row your way back to Africa. But it's fascinating to read into that. Well, number one, the longing for the homeland. Number two, the belief that you could reconnect with the homeland. Number three, the fact that water is a means of connection with the old world. So much that slaves, some of whom committed suicide, would drown because they believed that if they drowned, that water would connect them back home and their spirit would reach Africa. I mean, it sounds like an absurd action by that slave, but when you understand their culture and their beliefs, it makes perfect sense. Another one, I was just shocked when I was reading this many years ago, and actually I came across this document in Havana at the National Library. So plantations, and this is the late 1700s, usually had, if not a resident physician, more likely a physician that would make the rounds through to different plantations and treat the slaves for whatever maladies, diseases they were facing. So I was fortunate to find this manuscript by a physician who visited a particular plantation in Matanzas, Cuba, which was the buckle of the sugar belt in Cuba. And he writes stories about different patients. One of them was particularly striking. And again, this speaks to the mindset and the beliefs of slaves. So this slave was hurt. From what I gathered, he was hurt in one of the limbs, an arm, and he was sent to the infirmary in that plantation. A few days later, the physician comes and starts examining him, and later on he draws up a medical story for that slave, whose name we don't know. And this is what the story tells. One beautiful afternoon, that slave and other slaves wanted to be outside to enjoy the warmth of the afternoon, the beautiful blue skies. The head nurse, however, saw them going out and was upset by that and ordered them to come back into the infirmary. Apparently, most of them did, except for this one slave, who stayed there enjoying the afternoon and the beauty of the sky, the breeze, and so on. The head nurse shouts at him, and the doctor quotes what he said. And what the head nurse said was, "You dog, come inside immediately." What's fascinating and striking is the response of this man who responds and says, "I am not a dog. I am a Christian just like you." I mean, just imagine the power of that, of those words, the aspect that we talked about briefly earlier, the resistance to slavery. So on the one hand, slavery is a system based on the exploitation of the slaves. It's very hierarchical. The head nurse is a free person, therefore not a slave. We understand that. But we also understand that that slave had some religious knowledge. He had been taught probably by the resident priest about Christianity. And he saw Christianity, as many slaves did in the U.S. South, for example, as a religion of redemption. And they used the imagery of the Old Testament and the slaves and how Moses was the key actor in the liberation of the slaves in ancient Egypt. So this man has that response. Now, he walks inside to the room where his cot was, and he lays down. He does not stand up or have anything to drink or anything to eat for 3 days. At night, one night, he walks out of the infirmary, and he reaches the cemetery that was close to the infirmary. And he sits down there, and he dies. Now, it's a very sad story, but it's also a very beautiful story if you understand what all of this meant. Number one, he was publicly humiliated. That is something that to this day in West African cultures is something that can lead to depression and the desire to not live anymore. I've read this in contemporary books on culture and suicide in West African countries. So this man was humiliated. He became immediately depressed, and he lost all desire to live. Now, he doesn't just die anywhere. He goes to the slave cemetery, basically a potter's field, not quite a cemetery, and he sits there. Now, this is important because as a Christian, he knew that he could not commit suicide. That shows his understanding of the Christian faith. But as a West African man who still carried many of the cultural aspects of West African religiosity, he knows that if he goes to the cemetery and he dies there, he is being reconnected with his kin. Again, important West African notions of the afterlife. So it's stories like these that you can't really make up. And they're beautiful, even though sad in many cases, but there's great pleasure when you understand the culture surrounding those actions and the times, and you can understand, well, why did this happen? So those two stories, just like the one I mentioned earlier of Paula de Aguilú, are the types of examples of vignettes that I have been collecting and writing for several years, which should be my next book project.
Well, I definitely look forward to it. It sounds very interesting, and certainly narratives that haven't had a chance to be expressed and should be.
Yes, and they're also stories, like the ones I try to tell in Key to the New World.
So for listeners that would like to get a copy of Key to the New World, where can they find it?
Well, the easiest way would be to visit the webpage of the University Press of Florida. It's also available in Google and other vendors. That would be the easiest way, yes.
Dr. Luis Martinez Fernandez, I've really enjoyed our discussion. Thank you again for joining me.
Well, I have enjoyed it too. Thank you very much, Colin, and I hope that listeners will enjoy it as well.